Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Brian Deer. He's a longtime tech startup entrepreneur, and we're talking about his new book, The Friendly Orange Glow, The Untold Story of the Plato System and the Dawn of Cyberculture. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, you actually worked on the Plato System, right?
Yeah, I you know, you could say I was a fly on the wall for several years, and I think that gave me, you know, the ability to see the system, learn it, and get really used to it and everything. But also, in terms of writing a book, it helped me know what questions to ask, and more importantly, who to ask. And I think that may be one reason why no one ever wrote a book about this before, because it's like, where do you start? You know, and I had a really good idea where to start and who, made a list of people to go down. So that really, really helped get things going.
Now, let's set the stage for this. This takes place in Illinois, specifically where?
In Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, which is this pair of towns sort of glued at the hip and surrounded by miles and miles and miles of cornfields. It is the home of the University of Illinois.
Yep.
So it's a big, huge college town, one of the Big Ten schools, and it's a really remarkable place. You know, it's one of the greatest universities in the world, really, and renowned for engineering and physics and the hard sciences, as well as, you know, agriculture and all kinds of stuff. So it's a big deal, and even though it's out in the middle of nowhere, in a way, it's really only 2 hours from Chicago, and they've done some remarkable stuff over the years.
Now, one of the centers of the development of the Plato System is the Mechanical Engineering Lab and Powerhouse, which is this funky building. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the very first, well, let me back up real quick. You know, back in the day when the Plato System was booming and everything, and I was just a student at the University of Delaware, and Delaware had Plato. But then you hear that, like, oh, well, the cool place is Illinois. That's the birthplace of Plato, and that's where the main system is. And, of course, if you're like, fascinated by all this stuff, and it was hard not to be, this is late 70s we're talking, what you would do is get in the car and make a pilgrimage to Illinois.
That's right.
People jokingly but pretty seriously called it, you know, Mecca, because it was like where all the cool people hang out, and, you know, it's the birthplace of the orange glow, as it were. And so, you know, I went out there in like 1980 and fully expecting to see this gleaming ivory tower, you know, high-tech Silicon Valley, all glass kind of thing, you know, kind of like Apple would design or something. And instead, what I see is this really frumpy old brick building, which was 100 years old, or, well, at the time, I guess it was more like about 75 years old or something, but, you know, now it's over 100 years old. And, and then you go inside, and it's just, you know, linoleum floors and all these tiny little offices with cinder block walls, and it was downright Soviet. You know, it was like Cold War. All the desks were the squeaky metal desks with very squeaky chairs, and it took you a couple of minutes to adjust to that, but then you realize what's going on in that place.
Jesus.
Was just phenomenal, people were just amazing. And so
now I want to mention for the benefit of the audience that we're going to be doing like the Reader's Digest version of the classic comic version of the Cliff Notes of the book,
right?
Because there's a tremendous amount of information in here, but it's important for you to set the time stage. We're talking about the early 70s when this stuff originated. This is way before personal computers and a lot of other stuff have gone on. And these people were working and developing the system under amazing constraints. And we'll talk about that in a second. But let's, first of all, the Plato System was designed originally as an educational tool. Talk to me about how it was supposed to function.
Well, it started in 1960 as a project at at the Coordinated Science Lab at the University of Illinois, and their thinking was they wanted to build upon the research that had been done in the 50s, starting with B.F. Skinner at Harvard to develop teaching machines. Skinner had demonstrated one in 1954, so just 6 years earlier, and it was this crude thing that he had built himself, you know, out of plywood. It's now in deep storage at the Smithsonian Institution in D.C., and I got a look at it, and, you know, it looks like the kind of thing that, you know, students would put together for a high school science fair or something. Very, very primitive, but the idea was build a machine that a student can sit down with and interact with, and the machine will teach the student. This is the theory, you know, whatever subject it might be, mathematics or spelling or whatever. It is a gigantic leap to make that leap from like a living, breathing human being teacher to the point where you're arguing that a machine can do the same thing and it can do it far more efficiently, blah blah blah, and all that kind of stuff. And this is what Skinner and a lot of people in the 50s started believing. And by 1960, it was clear that the mechanical approach to building these, you know, teaching machines, which were really like Rube Goldberg devices. It was full of pulleys and levers, and some of them had the equivalent of like player piano scrolling paper in them, you know, with punch holes in them. Really crazy stuff. It was silly to do it that way. Now that digital computers were coming along, so the University of Illinois said, like, gosh, why don't we try this? And they put together a project. And it was headed by a 26-year-old, brand new PhD, brand new professor, Donald Bitzer, in 1960, and
Bitz.
Called it Play-Doh.
Let's just take a moment out and describe the hardware of this. I mean, it goes through different evolutions, but let's start with Play-Doh version one. It looks a little bit, you know, there's photographs in your book. It looks a little bit like an old home PC. There's different buttons for you to push. There's a screen. Where does the name Orange Glow come from?
Well, the Orange Glow would come later, but just to address the first part there, the Play-Doh project was so, you know, lightly funded that basically what they did was they found a used, beat-up, broken $10 television set, black and white, that the tuner didn't even work on it, so you couldn't actually watch TV on it. But the cathode ray tube, the CRT, and all that stuff worked fine. So they just rigged it up to plug into a bunch of circuitry and vacuum tubes and stuff, and they used that as the prototype, basically the proof of concept for the display that a student would interact with for Play-Doh version 1, which came out in the fall of 1960, and instead of a keyboard like we would recognize today, they had built this extremely crude little box that had 16 very crude buttons on it to do various things, but it didn't even have a full alphabetical keyboard or things like that. But it was just to prove that, you know, they could get that far, and then they built fancier keyboards, and all across the 1960s, they improved on the whole system and it expanded and all that. The Orange Glow comes from the fact that they realized pretty fast that if they were going to build, you know, their dreams were to build thousands of these terminals and get them in schools and universities all over the place. And if they could do that, then they could go to millions of terminals. But then they realized if they use, you know, typical video hardware, just like we have today on computers, and if you remember in the 90s, we had, you know, big, bulky video monitors before everybody started getting flat displays. Those video monitors required what was called random access memory or video RAM. And even in 1960, they realized that they would have to use RAM for every student's display. The problem is that in the early 60s, memory at the time cost $2 per bit.
I read that and I almost fell off my chair.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, your typical iPhone today that might have 64 gigabytes in it, there's combined in the world probably right up to, I would guess, into the 70s probably. But that would be, you know, I don't know, $500 million or something would be the cost of an iPhone at $2 a bit. And a Play-Doh terminal would probably cost something like $500,000 per terminal if they went that video RAM route. So they couldn't do it. So they scrounged around and looked for alternative approaches. And these guys, being very hardcore electrical engineers and physicists and other kinds of scientists, they fearlessly went where everyone else had feared to tread, which was to try to figure out. The holy grail was come up with a flat panel display that did not require memory, and they actually pulled it off. And so what you got, and it took 10 years for them to actually design it, build it, get a company to actually manufacture them in quantity, and at such a yield that it actually was, you know, they were coming off the assembly line without any bad pixels and that kind of thing. So by the time it finally came out in 1971, 72, you had a 512 by 512 flat panel display. It was a quarter inch thick, just glass. And each dot, each pixel was a little tiny bit of neon gas that would glow orange if the dot was on. And the real miracle of the invention was that when you looked at the display, you were looking at the memory. The display was the memory. So, you know, if you had certain pixels on that were displaying text or graphics or whatever, that was actually the memory, too. And an electrical signal would flow through the gas and keep it excited enough to stay lit, basically.
One of the weird things is that the power for this system, the power output, the power that they needed was tremendous. And didn't it periodically have to recycle all the time?
You may be referring to the earlier video versions when they were still rather small system.
Right.
Say Play-Doh 3, which existed from 1963 to 71. And there were maybe about 70 terminals scattered in various classrooms on campus and around Champaign-Urbana at various sites. And they used a conventional video display with what was at the time called a storage tube, which is basically a glorified vacuum tube. They're very, very expensive. You don't even use them anymore. But they were in use in the 50s and 60s. And a computer could essentially draw its display output into this storage tube, which then a signal could be sent to a conventional television or video display, and you would see, you know, the stuff on the screen. And so that's what they used. The problem is the storage tube kind of faded out over the course of a couple of minutes. So unless you refreshed the display or went on to the next page or whatever, you'd be sitting there and the screen would suddenly dim out and go black, basically, or gray. And so there was literally, you know, I think it was called a refresh button right on the keyboard for the student to just press that whenever, you know, the screen faded because of and it was just the nature of storage tubes at the time. But when they went to the gas plasma flat panel display, of course, that problem went away. And, you know, what you got instead was this brilliant orange glow. And everyone called it that. They called it the friendly orange glow. I didn't make that term up. people, you would literally walk into a darkened classroom that had, say, 32 Play-Doh terminals in it. And it looked just like you were walking into an air traffic control center. You know, it's all dark. And then everyone is hunched around these displays that are glowing with figures and texts and drawings and graphics and all that kind of stuff and output, you know, and that's the way it was. People preferred to, you know, work in the dark. It was just, it was, you know, it, in a way it was like st- staring at a campfire.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, that's the way the room would be lit. You know, if you had enough of these terminals around the room, it was very much like a campfire.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Brian Deer, longtime tech startup entrepreneur. And he has written, we're talking about a new book he has written that is one of the great tech histories I've read. The Friendly Orange Glow, The Untold Story of the Plato System and the Dawn of Cyberculture. Brian, I want to skip ahead tremendously. Now, the first part of this book, it's very much about the inventiveness and the creativity of these technologists and these computer people. But then the book takes a wild turn and you realize the social aspects of this computer is discovered. And everything changes dramatically. It sort of starts with the firing. Well, actually, it starts with the use of Plato to talk about this little creek that runs through there. That was one thing. But then the firing of Archibald Cox by Nixon. And Plato was used to cover the Saturday Night Massacre.
Right.
And that was a huge problem. That was a huge problem. Why?
Well, basically what happened was, you know, this was the era of Watergate. And, you know, this was 1973, it was about October of 73, and it was already very apparent to, on what was now Plato version 4, which was the big mainframe version of Plato running on essentially a supercomputer, a multi-million dollar machine, and there were thousands of terminals starting to be installed everywhere and everything. And these are the orange displays and everything. So the user community, which by then had really grown tremendously and included a lot of high school kids and undergrads from the university, those young people had realized that, you know, Plato is pretty cool as an educational system, but it's way cooler as a communications platform. And what I argue with this book, I posit that the Plato system represents the dawn of the interpersonal computer revolution.
I'll tell you, after reading the book, I buy that.
Before the personal computer revolution even got underway, which is, you know, if you state that out in Silicon Valley, it's considered heresy. But or around Route 128, probably in Boston. But the facts are the facts. What this story uncovers is the fact that the history of social computing is far richer, in some ways far stranger, and certainly far more exciting and interesting and unusual than anyone knew. You know, the story of Plato belongs right up there in the halls of fame, with Apple and Microsoft and Xerox PARC and everything else that has dozens of books written about it already. And what really is phenomenal is that this book is the very first ever to, that goes deep on Plato.
Wait a minute, I want to get back to the story of Archibald Cox. The problem with
covering
covering that is, that wasn't it in some way linked up to ARPANET?
Yeah, so it talked about.
So you had an anti-Nixon. You had an anti-Nixon rant on Plato.
Yeah,
and you were very much in danger of getting in trouble with the government.
Well, what happened was this one guy, his name was Stuart Umpleby. He was a grad student at the time, and he was really a big believer in using Plato and any computer as a communications platform and for social good, basically. So he was a very early thinker on this stuff, and he fully believed that Nixon needed to be impeached, and you know he was following Watergate closely and everything, and he started what was called an online discussion in a program called Discuss on Plato. Where he basically said, hey, you know, the Saturday Night Massacre just happened. I think it's time that we impeach Nixon. What do you all think? And then a whole bunch of students replied, and people started yakking about it, just like in any online forum we've all been there, or on Twitter, something like that. And as it went along, he started advocating that college campuses should start rallies to call for the impeachment of Nixon. And then he was starting, you know, the people egged him on and everything. And it was like, gosh, why don't we just use all these computer networks to get the word out even faster to other campuses?
Wow.
And then what he did was at the University of Illinois, at the Plato lab, there happened to be an ARPANET terminal sitting right next to a Plato terminal in one particular room. And so what he would do is the epitome of what you might call sneakernet. He literally would get up and go to the other terminal and retype in everything he had just typed in on Plato. So in a message forum that was on the ARPANET. And so there were parallel discussions going on both networks. And it just so happened that, you know, the ARPA, or which is now called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, part of the Pentagon, and the National Science Foundation funded Plato, and ARPA funded ARPANET. So that meant that the White House and the executive branch and the Pentagon were all keeping an eye on what was going on these networks. And suddenly Don Bitzer, you know, who's the head honcho of the Plato Project, gets a phone call in his hotel room. He's about to go on and give a talk in Philadelphia. And, you know, and it's the government, and they're freaking out, saying, like, what the heck is going on online? You know, the White House, it was basically apparently Kissinger's office that was furious and was threatening to not only shut down Plato, but also ARPANET and defund both projects because they were furious that these computer networks were being used to talk about political speech and to about, you know, impeaching the president and the administration that had basically funded them. So it was a real comical situation, but on a serious note, if you think about it, this probably represents the first instance of government, you know, what you'd call cyber censorship, you know, or at least the threat of censorship. And in the end, cooler heads prevailed, as I document what happened in the book. But it's a wild ride, and it was unprecedented. You know, I mean, and this kind of thing happened every single day on Plato because everything they did was a first.
That's right.
There were no predecessors, no precursors that you could look back on.
Well, yeah, I mean, the things that go on in your book, the first example of what could be called phishing was done on Plato. The first what you could be called emoticons were done on Plato.
Plato had its own emoji, basically. Yeah.
And the number of games that were developed. And by the way, a lot of this had to do with the influx of high school students who just sort of ran with it. I mean, there was a description that you write in the book is they would show up at the building and there was no like security. They would just sort of walk in the building and there'd be people working there. And, you know, if they sort of appeared to know what they were doing, then they were just sort of left alone, even though they didn't belong there.
Well, even better than that, oftentimes they were encouraged to check out the system and get working, basically. I mean, you might be a 12-year-old wandering in because you'd heard about this wild and crazy futuristic computer called Plato with, you know, its orange display. And the other thing about the displays was they were touch sensitive. So, you know, you could touch the display too. I mean, and interact with the system that way. I mean, this was years before this kind of thinking would become mainstream. And, you know, imagine you're 12 years old, you wander in and you sit down, or maybe you go to the trash can and rifle through the computer printouts to find passwords and stuff. And instead of getting kicked out and maybe the police coming or whatever, you know, some official figure who worked there might come over and say, like, hey, what are you doing? Like, would you like to take a look at this system? And, you know, or do you want to learn how to program? And, okay, here's a problem. Go write this. Go solve this. Here's a book. Bring it back on Monday. That kind of thing. And it was that kind of culture that not only encouraged the community to be involved, but it created a desire by a lot of these kids to get jobs at the laboratory,
right.
And they wound up
That's right.
And oftentimes that set their whole career in motion. And a lot of these kids are currently either retired because they worked 20 years at Apple and then, say, 10 years at Google, and they're like multimillionaires, or they're still at Google or Apple or Microsoft,
That's
or
right.
you name it. I mean, the Plato wave of techies is still all over the industry.
First of all, there's a great photograph in your book of what's called the zoo, which was that you, and it looks, you can really, you, if you're if you're old enough and you recognize that first passion you had for computers, it's people sitting around, they're different terminals. It's just amazing. Now, we're almost out of time. I want to mention the first blog, the first news reports were developed by people on Plato. The story of Red Sweater, people have to read the book to learn about him. But I want to make sure.
That's the first, as far as I know, that's the first online newspaper.
And it's great.
That created original content, had a huge following, and it was crowdsourced.
We have 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
What happens on September 1st, 2015?
So that was the day that the basically the last vestiges of a live Plato system shut down. The last commercial version of it. It's a long history, but very briefly, one part of Plato had forked off and taken on a different name, even though it was exactly the same system for many years, and it was called Novanet. And Novanet did very, very well and was very successful in its marketplace. It was profitable for many, many, many years. It was eventually acquired by a number of companies that in turn would get acquired and that kind of thing, to the point where Pearson, the big British conglomerate, you know, multi-billion dollar multinational corporation, owned Novanet.
Brian, we're going to run out. We're out of time.
Okay.
But you're going to, you know what? People are going to have to buy the book. So there's a tremendous end scene here where old users gathered around the friendly orange glow and watched that last vestige of it happen. And that is worth the price of admission alone. This is an amazing story. My guest tonight is Brian Deer, longtime tech startup entrepreneur and the author of an amazing book, The Friendly Orange Glow, The Untold Story of the Plato System and the Dawn of Cyberculture. It's an amazing story. Brian, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.